Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 122, I want to say. My name is Scroobius Pip. Thank you for tuning in, guys. First of all, dear Lord, what a beautiful reaction and general support of last week's podcast. It means the world. I always ask for people to push, like when it's a charity one or dealing with a heavy or taboo subject, I always hope that you guys are going to get behind it and help get the word out there and spread it. But I'm still always overwhelmed by quite the force with which you do act and push and tweet and get the word out there. So thank you very much for that. Last week's, if you missed it, was with Dignity in Dying, a wonderful charity battling to give people with terminal illness in the UK the right to have a dignified and peaceful death. So yeah, thank you for tuning in. Another thing I'm always overwhelmed with is the velocity with which you support speechdevelopmentrecords.com, which is my record label. I don't know if I should announce it. I won't announce it yet, but we've got a new release coming soon. Before the end of the year, we're releasing a new artist and album that it's someone that's been on the podcast before and got a huge reaction. And we kind of came up with it last minute, and I'll explain later, but it's very exciting. But for now, you can head there and get all your winter goods. You can get Scroobius Pip bobble hat. You can get Speech Development Records jacket. There's two different Scroobius Pip jumpers. We've got tons of Distraction Pieces merch. We've got three different T-shirt designs, two different designs in four different colours. We've got mugs. We've got all sorts of stuff. You can get a Team 3W Distraction Pieces podcast mug for your winter warming drink. So yeah, head over to speechdevelopmentrecords.com and support everything there. Also a great place for Christmas gifts. We've got a lot of signed stuff, so you can get my DVD signed or either of my two books signed or my album signed on vinyl and loads of other bits of signed stuff from different people on the label and all sorts of stuff. And that's always, you know, a cool one for Christmas gifts. So head over there and check that out. On to this week's guest. It's Jeff Lloyd, who I love and adore. This was a great chat, man. He was quite... I've been trying to get Jeff on for ages, and he's a fan of the podcast, and he kept saying, look, I just don't think I'm going to be interested enough. Dear Lord, I think you guys are going to disagree, because it was one of the most engaging and open conversations I've ever had. And let him know that as well on Twitter. I make sure he knows, but... it was a great episode. He was hugely open and honest. I need to tell you, though, that afterwards, when we stopped recording, he asked if I wanted to use his toilet. And his upstairs toilet, he was given, I think because of the radio show, this Japanese toilet that cleans your bum, blow dries your bum. You can change the angle and temperature of the water of the jet of air. It sounded amazing. It's the most gutted I've ever been that I didn't need a poo. So I didn't get to use it. I thought it'd be weird to just go in and have a bit of a go on the jet, because that's creepy. He's a wall away from me. It's a weird situation. But yeah, if anyone wants to send me a special science future toilet, I don't need one, to be completely honest. I'm fine with my toilet, but it was weird, man. I just wanted to share that with you. Anyway, let's get on with the podcast. In fact, I'll mention now, in case you don't get to the outro, because sometimes I know that you'll hear the interview and then you'll jog on the outro. I get that. Next week, I've got Ian Lee. Now, a lot of you have been after this for a long time, and it truly lives up to expectation. It was an amazing chat. Me and Ian only met a few weeks back, and I just feel a great connection with him. I've been a fan of him for years, but I went on Ian's show on Talk Radio, which is available as a podcast, so I recommend you check that out. Yeah, I went on there a month or so ago now. So if you want to go and do some pre-search, it's like research but pre-search ahead of next week's episode, then go and do that and check that out. It's available online. But yeah, Ian Lee's fantastic. It's a great chat. So that'll be next week. But for now, enjoy the wonder that is Jeff Lloyd on the Distraction Pieces podcast.
intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces.
I have to warn the sound man that I use a mic properly, because most spoken word artists, it's waving around the room, and I'm, because of rapping and not wanting to get feedback and get everything clear, it's glued to my top lip.
You look like one of those old, you know, the old boxing commentators of it.
Exactly. I like that. So I'm really used to that. But then equally, because I'm not a cool American rapper, I like the first time we had B Dolan, two of us, he got annoyed with our sound man because our sound man kept going, right, you're cupping the mic. That's causing feedback. It's bad. But again, that's generally, that's a rap way of holding the mic. Proper hold it. You have it twisted around your arm. And yeah, it's an odd one. But yeah, if nothing else in my career, I'll be remembered by a sound man for always having impeccable mic control and mic skills. I've started a recording in that cool way that podcasters do.
Yeah.
Just mid, because we're not the system and we're not the man, we can just start at any point. It's so wild and crazy.
I think if I did that, there'd just be this excruciating small talk. Because I always worry about saving it for the interview. So if somebody comes in, you know, you just want to get a bit of level and then get going. Because what if they say something great before you start recording?
Completely. And when I've been on your show before, Absolute and stuff like that, it's kind of, that's how it's, like, you should have, here's the area you're going to wait. And because it's live as well, you'll generally just get me in just before we're going to go to air.
Yeah.
That's the way, that's logical. Because then there isn't that kind of, oh, actually, I've done this. As long as everyone's comfortable and knows what's going on. I should introduce, I'm joined by Jeff Lloyd. How are you, sir?
I'm well.
Dog, Laika.
Hey, Laika. Hey, Laika. She's desperate for attention. You came in and she made such a fuss of you.
She did.
I was disappointed that you declined my offer of a grilled cheese sandwich.
Yeah. I turned it down. I mean, now you've, I mean, in again, we started talking before I was set up, and we were discussing food trucks, and you expressed a love and almost a worldly experience of good grilled cheese sandwiches.
I feel pretentious calling it grilled cheese, though, because it's really cheese on toast or a cheese toastie.
Yeah.
But there's this Americanization in recent years where they call it grilled cheese, which I don't care that much about Americanizations. And in my defense, my wife's American, my brother-in-law runs a food truck in Chicago.
Yeah.
So, you know, most of my experience of grilled cheese comes from that. But anyway, do you ever go to Borough Market in London?
I've been a few times.
So there's this one grilled cheese or cheese on toast stall, whatever you want to call it, and the queues are insane,
really
insane. And it's worth it. It's one of those rare occasions where it's worth the wait. So I've been eating these toasties whenever I was down there, like over the years, and then I went online and did some deep Googling, and I found the recipe, and it's like three different types of cheese and spring onions and red onion, white onion. So it's desperate to make you one of those, not because I wanted to show off that I could make the sandwich, but because
just
then it would
give the best grilled.
But no, because then I would be able to eat one, because it would feel sort of like the amount of effort involved and the guilt would be too much for me to make it for lunch on a Friday, which is what this is.
It's weird, isn't it? How much Americanization are we have over it? And I'm not against it, because most of it is food that is really my kind of thing. It'll be meats and barbecue stuff and stuff like that we get crazy for, and it's all quite simple. But the grilled cheese is a weird one. I remember the first time I was doing a lot of gigs in America, and we didn't, again, over here, a cheese toastie isn't something you get excited about.
No, there's nothing gourmet
really,
about
there's
it.
Nothing, but over there, it's like, oh, they do the best grilled cheese in the world. It's like, the best? Yeah. So they do the best, they said, cheese on toast.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't know if I just bought into it because of the setup, but I was finding myself, I'd go into place and go, yeah, I'm going to have a grilled cheese. I shouldn't be looking forward to a grilled cheese. I should be thinking there should be something else. It's weird. So I like that that's now something that's coming over here.
But
5-10 years ago, if you'd said there's this place, queues around the block for their toasted cheese sandwiches, you'd go, no, mate. Just get a Breville.
But you wouldn't have it because you're really disciplined about what you eat during the week.
I am in the week, yeah. I
tried to persuade you, because today is a Friday. I tried to persuade you that Friday's a weekend, but
I'd
you're having
really
none of it.
I get really embarrassed about this kind of stuff, because we discussed it briefly when I was on your show last, in fact, which came out as a podcast as well. If anyone wants to go and listen to that as well. I've got into my fitness in the last year, or since the beginning of this year, and one of the things that It's a really interesting thing, because my mate Amy was saying the other day how strong my willpower is, that I won't eat chocolate or particularly cheese and stuff like that. Like anything particularly unhealthy in the week, I generally won't, unless there's a birthday or something like that, which my mum's birthday was the other day and I pigged out like crazy. But in general, it's that. But it's not discipline. It's genuinely, I think it takes 4 to 5 weeks to change habit.
Right.
So I don't have that craving. Like it's not. I always feel awkward at saying to people, "Oh no, I don't eat," because I hate people who are really always pushing. Oh, I'm healthy. I do this.
Yeah,
I do that.
Yeah.
It's like, cool, man. So it's only if I'm asked,
right? Because
it's habit forming. And at the weekend, I'm all over. I'll be having pizza and ice cream and all sorts of stuff.
But I'm all over.
I don't have that craving anymore in the week, because
that's amazing.
Again, originally, I would, but I genuinely think it's. It's habit forming. It's exactly the same that if you have to get up 6 or 7 o'clock every day for work in the week, you'll kind of start to naturally wake up at that time. But that won't mean you naturally wake up at that time on Saturday and Sunday. You'll naturally, your body will go, it's the weekend, I can sleep in later. And things like that, I genuinely think... Our minds and bodies are weird things.
That's amazing, because I'm an alcoholic. I've not had a drink since 2001. And
so I'm not meaning to suggest you'll be fine having drinks at weekends.
Yeah, well, this is it, because so I didn't do AA or anything like that. And, with 16 years of hindsight or whatever it is, I wish I had. But, the reason I found it easier, the reason I didn't find it particularly easy, it could took me a few goes, but the reason I think I can do it is because it's binary, it's either on or off.
Yeah.
So what would be really difficult for me would be to go out for a meal and have 3 glasses of wine. So it feels really counterintuitive that you would be able to not do something during the week and then binge on a weekend.
But again, it's your approach and look at it. I can still look at it as a binary approach, because I can look at it as I haven't had chocolate in the week for this amount of time. It's still on or off. It's still off. On the week, do you know what I mean? So it's still looking at that. And I think anything like that, it's why, whilst I moan about it, I don't think it's a bad thing if you need to tell people all the time about the exercise you're doing or how long it's been since you last had a cigarette or whatever else, because that can be a great motivating factor. The fact that you can post on Twitter again that you've gone for another run. Again, that kind of stuff kills me. It's not my way, but I also know that can be enough to motivate you to do it.
So I have
the motivation anyway to do it. But if you don't, I can understand how getting to post saying at the gym again to show how disciplined you are. Do you know what I mean? I can understand that.
With you, like, what is your motivation? Because you're tall. What are you, like, 6'2"?
Yeah, I'm 6'4".
Right, 6'4". So you're never going to get fat unless you really, you know, let yourself go.
I mean, it's surprising. I can put on weight. I can get fat and podgy. And it's a weird one, because there's a lot of me. So I do start to put... I'm big anyway, as such.
Right.
I'm kind of tall and skinny, but I'm big anyway. But it's purely just... hormone enjoyment of health.
Right. I've never had that. You know, the thing where people say, if you exercise, you feel good. And people say, you know, exercise is like an antidepressant. For me, it just feels like I want to die every time I do any exercise.
I think a lot of people who say that are masking the truth behind it. I think as humans, we all naturally have a level of egocentricness. And the fact is, I'm never out and about with my top off or posting pictures on Instagram of workout. But if in the morning I walk past the mirror and I think, oh, I'm in good shape at the moment, it's positive.
You're saying that in your house, the mirrors aren't all covered up then?
No.
I can't imagine what that would be like.
Yeah. Oh, that's it. It's weird. I have got a kind of phobia of mirrors, but only if they're not in the right place. I've got mirrors in the bathroom. So you don't like to be caught unaware? Yeah, I've got mirrors in the bathroom. I hate it if I'm at a bar and there's a mirror, or I'm in a venue or hotel or sitting somewhere. I struggle to relax if I know out the corner of my eye I can see my reflection of myself.
Is that because the idea you've got of yourself in your head is different? You see it in a mirror and you say, oh God, that's what I look like after all.
I guess it's a thing of having to be somehow self-aware. I've also got a weird... kind of a selfie phobia, which shocks people because I take selfies for every podcast. Yeah, but again, it's work. It's a different thing. In general, if you go on my social media, any pictures I post are from photo shoots or from, you know, a specific things. I'm weird about just pictures of myself for no reason. And it's why a lot of people, again, will laugh and joke that in... Because at gigs, I'll always man the merch and have photos as long as you want.
Yeah.
People often say I look like a cardboard cutout because I pull the exact same face in every photo.
Right, yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
And that's part of a coping thing for it. It's that worry of if I'm trying to look cool every time, 90% of the time, I won't be happy with how I look. Whereas if the face I always go for is a shocked look, which shocked, incidentally, is wide-eyed, which removes the risk of blinking and looking weird or deformed in the photo. So yeah, I have this standard shock look I go through, and it's a defense mechanism in ways of going.
How do you feel? Because I've had friends who do your job, like musicians, and I've met people like with successful careers, and you know, the stage where maybe you're playing a venue the size of the Hammersmith Apollo or whatever, who after a gig, when you expect they're going to be at some after show party, they're at home untagging photos of themselves on Facebook that fans have put up there because they don't look flattering.
I'm not in that a realm. I'm fine with all that. I think live is live. I really enjoy being on stage and performing and doing the gig. So,
and you don't mind that being captured in perpetuity?
No. Again, it's I'm not under the illusion that I'm going to look perfect in any picture. So it's kind of fine in that respect. But I am one that... I will be after the gig in my hotel room quite early and either doing my accounts or rewarding myself with... when I used to... Like, I hardly drink in general these days, not through any great issue or problem, but it stopped appealing. But it used to be that I'd often be in my hotel room with a glass of rosé and a bath after a gig, which is...
Lighting a candle.
So rock and roll. but yeah, more often... Either not as well, but because I've always run my own merch and all that.
Yeah.
I'll be in my hotel room, I'll be cashing up, I'll be planning the next day and figuring things out and not.
It's interesting because it sort of breaks some of the. Because what you do for a job in some way adheres to the rules of theatrics.
Yeah.
But that breaks the rule. If you're there at a table taking money off people afterwards,
yeah.
That's kind of.
I like it though. I like the. I like the break in that. I always remember and. It's amazing he's on my label now and a good friend now, but I always remember the first time I went to see Sage Francis and he was about before the gig and running the merch after the gig. It was like, oh, wow. It's one of the things that inspired me to do what I do because it's like, oh, right, he's just a human.
Yeah.
And it's the story behind the Just a Band section in Thou Shalt. The point of that is to say these are just individuals. These are just regular people. Yeah. And whilst a lot of people felt that was insulting bands... It's not. It's meant more as an inspirational and aspirational thing to say, look, that could be you. They're just like, there's millions of bands. They're one that it happened to click.
Yeah.
And here they are now. That could be anyone. And that was exactly it. So that's, I like that. The one time I've stayed off of it was the first time we sold out Coco. And it's a beautiful venue. And I was like, and normally I'll watch all the support acts and things like that. But for that one, I was like, I want the first time anyone who's here tonight to see me.
You wanted to feel it go mental.
Be when I walk on stage, not I'm standing there and then, oh, I'd best get off.
Yeah.
And then you dart off. I wanted that to be that special thing. So
I've heard that as a technique for people who are nervous about public speaking, that a good thing to do is go out and be amongst the people who are going to be watching because then it humanises them.
Yeah.
You don't just see them as like one homogenous
group
of scary...
It takes a bit of the pressure off because... Yeah. As weird as it is, you're not meeting all of them at once for the first time that evening.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Although it's odd, you've chatted to them, there's a few you've already introduced yourself to and you know that they're on board and they're not evil or horrible or there to throw things at you.
Yeah. I get terrified. Like I because my job is radio and I'm in a studio, really, most of the time with people I've known for a long time. If I ever have to do something on a stage, be it introduce a band or speak at a conference or, you know, do a speech at a wedding or something, I get myself sick
it's
with
nerves. It's weird because people will assume, look at Laika giving me a little nudge to stroke him or stop stroking
him. I know, she would just like, stop stroking her and she'll pour at you. Me.
It's weird because people would assume that because of your job, I'm sure your friends or whoever else will think, it'll be great to do a speech here or do that. And I'm the same. It's so specific. It's like I'm you're one of the reasons I think we instantly got on air and have had numerous relaxing interactions is you're incredibly at home and comfortable there. It's somewhere where it's all okay. You're completely in control. I don't get the feeling of any nerves in that situation, but it's very specific.
Yeah, I'm nervous in very much every other situation, like social interactions, everything. I get such anxiety.
Generally, any time I hear anyone close to me is getting married, I have a bit of dread that they're going to ask me to be their best man.
Have you ever done it?
No, I haven't, thankfully.
I did it once, and no exaggeration. Do you have that thing where you will remember something you did 15 years ago and you'll get a pang of anxiety and straight back your life, thinking, I'm a dick, I'm an awful person. I did a best man speech 5-6 years ago, and I'm so traumatised by it that I couldn't tell you what I said or how it went. Yeah. But probably once or twice a week, I'll just be walking along the street. And I'll go, "Oh God, why didn't I think that through better?"
It's horrendous.
And I can't even bring it up with my best friend whose wedding it was because I feel such shame that I did a bad job of it.
Have you ever? I mean, you've won numerous radio awards.
Yeah.
Have you ever prepared a speech or anything?
No, and It's a funny one when you get nominated for an award because like there's this elate, well, for me anyway, like I feel elation that I've been nominated for an award, and then I feel abject terror at the thought of having to go up and collect an award. Yeah. I just get so nervous, and I'm quite fortunate in that I've been nominated for far more awards than I've won.
Yeah,
I've not been in that situation very often.
You get the elation and then the relief. I was on. I was talking to Ian Lee a while ago, who's going to be on the podcast next week, isn't he? Yeah. And I was saying to him, he mentioned the one time I won a Rage Award, and I was saying, yeah, I hadn't prepared anything. And he was like, "Oh, no, that was very clear."
Did he say that to you?
Yeah, but in a nice way, because I did. I got up there just excited, and I think being who I am, I swore quite a bit in an excited manner, and I didn't mean it to be offensive. I was just like, "This is fucking crazy. This is nuts." And I remember I raved about David Rodigan, Zane Lowe and Eddie Temple Morris.
Yeah.
Because they were all in the room and all had helped me get, or either were in the same category or had given me some guidance in some way. And I was like, amazing. And
People will have loved that though, because it's so rare actually for somebody to go up and receive an award and care
genuinely
and
care.
Name check their peers, because again, there's like such a weird kind of bitchiness and rivalry.
It's a similar one where I have that same shame as you were saying, like when thinking of that, because I went up there with my producer Dan Rido, who is at least 50% of the show that we did. I had no experience in radio, so he really was a god. And I, in my head, obviously, he was going to get to talk as well. That's not how it went. So the one person I didn't thank was the guy that's at least 50% of the show. He never speaks, but he does all the work.
And
I just had this rambling thing about how much I love all these different people in the industry. And then we walked off and Chris at XFM, when I came off, the first thing he said was, you realise he didn't mention Dan? And I was like...
But there's always going to be somebody you forget, unless you're one of these people who gets on the laundry list.
That they're going to be stood right next to you as you forget them. But it's weird because at the live podcast at Leicester Square, he came along, and I was really adamant he came along, and I got him up on stage for a bit of a chat because I was like, and I apologised in that situation because I was like, look, there's people here as well.
Yeah,
it still plays on my mind, but. Because again, a lot of the people who got into Distraction Pieces were into The Beatdown, which was our radio show. So it's like, that was. So let's get back to you.
I tend to always divert in a conversation. I will always ask questions because I completely feel uncomfortable talking about myself.
I mean, one of the things I often jump about a bit with timelines. So I do want to talk about how you got into radio. I want to talk about when you were growing up, if radio appealed, if music was, because you from what I know of you, you're hugely fanatic about areas of music, and I want to talk about all of that. But before we get to that, I want to talk about exactly what you've just said there. One of the things I think you've always stood out on radio at is interviewing people and interviewing guests, and you've had some amazing interviews over the year, and it is a very specific and different skill. There's two different, like, presenting a radio show is one thing, and interviewing a guest is another thing, and they're not necessarily mutually exclusive, or they can be mutually exclusive. But an example I was thinking of this morning is Chris Miles, and some love him, some hate him.
Right.
Undeniable, he's very successful at presenting a show.
Yeah.
Like, he can talk for hours.
Yeah, yeah.
His audience love it. And again, I don't want to get into any debates on if he's sexist or homophobic or any of the things he said. Because again, I support either side of that argument, or maybe the side that's against him a bit more. But it's similar to, I've said before, that I think, and it angers people, I think Tony Blair is one of the best politicians that Britain's ever had. Now, I think he's a horrible human.
Yeah.
I think he did horrible things. But I think on the pure, as a politician, he was incredibly skilled
at
politics, and as a politician, it doesn't mean I'm endorsing him as a human.
And also as a communicator. So in the run-up to the referendum, I was watching Andrew Marra, one of those shows, and they had him on, and he spoke so clearly.
Yeah.
And you thought, if you hadn't completely destroyed your own reputation and been responsible for atrocities, like, you could have swung that referendum. You were communicating this in one interview better than any of the speeches or debates I've heard.
From his, or for his whole career, his public speaking was impeccable, similar to Obama in that way. Particularly in the UK, we hadn't had anyone in a long time that was in any way engaging. So we suddenly had this charismatic, engaging guy. He was also, again, from a political point of view, he was good at playing the sides. We don't live in a country where you can go, we're in, here's how it's all going to be. You have to play the sides and win, concede certain battles and all this. So I think as a politician, he was great. Again, I think as a human, there's a possibility he's the devil, but as and again, that's now a very damning comparison to Chris Moyles. But yes, so back to Chris Moyles as a presenter.
Yeah.
He's amazing. He can speak for hours and hours. It's always up. There's no lulls. As an interviewer, I don't know. I don't remember the classic Chris Moyles interviews, because he's such a big character. I would assume he struggles to step back and allow someone else into the limelight, which is what I think you're amazing at, and what is key to interviewing in many ways.
I feel like, actually, so I've interviewed people for years and years, going back to when I was on local radio in Manchester, and I used to think it should be like, a bit of a song and dance. Okay, what can we get the guest doing? You know, what crazy, wacky thing can we do with the guest? And then a few years ago, not that long ago, probably since listening to podcasts more and more, I'm really interested in these long form interviews, and so I just like listen to you a little bit, or listen to Howard Stern in the States and how they do it, and it's just really engaging to me hearing somebody get someone to open up. So I've been trying to get better at that. I think I'm getting better at it. I've had lots of amazing people on, and
definitely. What kind of highlights spring to mind? Is there a point where you kind of thought, right, I'm getting it now? Like a particular guest or anyone that's opened up in a particular way?
Right, yeah. I don't know. Actually, this isn't a great example of that. But like every now and again, you'll get an interview that seems to make a difference in terms of how people are listening to it. So when I was on local radio in Manchester, we had George Michael on after he'd been on for years. And he came on and he had like this really great sense of humour. It's after he'd gone away in the 90s and said, I'm not going to do pop videos anymore, he came on, he had this really good sense of humour, and then all of a sudden, like around town in Manchester, people were talking about it, and the Manchester News reporting it, and that seemed to make a difference. So every now and again you'll get one like that, and the recent one was the Ed Miliband.
And that got a lot of press and coverage, people saying it was
and at the time, because I'd seen Ed Miliband speak. I'd go to some of the like Fabian Society events, and I found him really warm at those events. And then when you saw him on the TV, he wasn't coming across in the same way. So I just thought, I wonder if you can kind of get him to be in an interview context like he is when he's just sort of answering questions from people in the room at those things.
Yeah.
So just sort of that was one. And then the people at the radio station tell me that in terms of the publicity they got for that, if they'd spent that much on advertising in the press, it would have cost them £750,000.
That's insane, isn't it?
Yeah, but it was funny at the time because, you know, I did it and I thought that went quite well. And then it went out on the radio and nobody really paid very much attention to it.
Yeah.
And then they video all the, you know, those big interviews these days, like the one we did with you a while ago. That's on YouTube. And that went nuts. And people like The Independent and BuzzFeed and all these people were tweeting it and doing articles about it, saying, this is the interview that could mean Ed Miliband is our next prime minister, finally. Yeah. And so I got carried away at the time, and I'm thinking, oh, maybe I'll get a seat in the House of Lords. and then on election night, I was just as disappointed as everyone else, if not more so.
So you've been in radio a long time, and how have you seen it kind of adapting and adjusting in recent years? Because that's a great example of how the filmed interviews, because of sharing it on social media, on Facebook and all these kind of things, that's where things are going to blow up a bit. It's not quite in the same place it used to be of, right, we've got Ed Miliband on Friday, let's have a look at what impact that's had by Saturday. So
it's not necessarily the case
because people are so, I don't think there's as much of a nature of tuning every day at a certain time and so on.
And it's depressing as well. Like I've kind of removed myself from it a bit in terms of, you know, the way things work within the radio station. But there's a lot of, you'll have a really good guest on and they're not interested in how good that interview is.
Yeah.
They're interested in, you know, can you ask them about the X Factor? Can you ask them about Jeremy Corbyn?
Yeah.
So that then they'll be able to spin that out into PR,
snippet.
I don't know what they think, you know, what good they think it's going to do. Like somebody's going to be reading The Sun and says, Scroobius Pip speaking in an interview with Absolute Radio said that he thinks Jeremy Corbyn's front garden's fine.
Yeah.
Like, and what do they think? That people are going to see that tiny snippet and think, I'll tune into Absolute Radio.
From now on.
Yeah, it's...
It is a weird one, isn't it? Because, as soon as you make that snippet, it becomes... An entity of its own in many ways. Like that snippet is no longer attached to the radio station or to the show.
It cheapens what an interview is.
Yeah.
So I don't want to get people in really and feel as if I'm tricking them into saying something that the radio station will be able to get publicity out of. So as I say, I've kind of extracted myself from that side of things a bit. And I just do these long interviews now where I'm just sort of, it's a combination of like thinking, okay, what am I interested in knowing about this person? What are people sort of more widely interested in knowing about this person, and what is this person not sick of being asked? Because you know, you do interviews and you're asked the same questions all the time, so you sort of think, and it's maybe a combination of neediness on my part to want to be liked by the guest, and also just trying to make it a more pleasant experience for the guest by thinking, okay, what don't they get asked about?
And I think that gets the best interviews as well. If you're not, I think if you work for the BBC, maybe, because it's a public service, you've got a responsibility to ask certain questions. If you don't, then you can ask what the fuck you want.
Yeah.
And particularly if it's, again, if it's a guest that you're on these, I've never had a thought that I'm going to try and catch someone out.
Yeah.
Try and ask them this awkward or tough question.
Yeah.
I've been discussing for a while with, I'm sure he won't mind me saying, I've been discussing with Edgar Wright to come on.
Right.
And he was saying, look, I don't want to come on right now because I don't want to talk about all the Marvel stuff. Because obviously he was on a Marvel film.
He's like,
I don't want to talk about... And I kind of had to say, it's like, well, we won't then.
Yeah.
It's like, it's not that kind of thing. Like, it doesn't have to be...
No.
Well, here's the question. I'd happily address at the start, look, let's not bother. Like, because if you don't mention it, then people are going to argue. But I'd happily just go, look, we're not going to talk about Marvel.
Yeah.
You know, so... Yeah. How's this going? How's this and how's that?
I just want to get it.
If that loses listeners, then cool.
I just want to hear what type of person that is. And surprising, like when you came on, you started talking about having been on a chocolatier course.
Yeah.
Like the other stuff about your records or whatever, I can go on Wikipedia and learn that.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's not going to crop out this particular, the reason American chocolate tastes like vomit is because it's got this particular thing in it that you learned about on a chocolate course.
Yep, 100%.
That's far more interesting to me.
It's good facts and good interesting. It's weird because on a podcast though, you do have to find the balance as well. I always remember Maynard J. Keenan from Tool was on Joe Rogan's podcast, and he doesn't do a lot of interviews.
Right.
A lot of people were excited about that. And the whole interview was about, he's either got a vineyard or a coffee growing thing. And he just talked constantly about it. And it was great.
Yeah.
I loved it.
Because
I'm not that, I don't know that much about him anyway.
Yeah.
It's not like I'm like, oh, I need to hear the stories. But I guarantee there was an
awful lot, because he's someone who people are fanatic about.
Yeah.
There was an awful lot of fans tuning in going, 10 minutes in, going, all right, well, are we going to get onto music now? Nope, right, we're just talking about beans and seeds and
fruit. I think that's fine. And you're not going to please everybody. Remember the first time we had McCartney on the programme? I mean, I'm so excited because I'm such a fan. We did this interview, which was really silly, and it showed what a good sense of humour he has and how, you know, he's maybe a bit different to how people perceive him.
Yeah.
And then after the interview, I was really pleased with it. And then after it aired, I looked at the email box in the studio and it said, what a waste of an opportunity. And I think, there's too much to ask him. And also, every now and again, somebody like that will be interviewed. And it happened earlier this year with him that he did some big BBC, the McCartney master tapes thing.
Yeah.
And all the newspapers are reporting, Paul McCartney says he had a breakdown when the Beatles were splitting up. He said he went to Scotland and he drank whiskey and he grew a beard and he didn't get out of bed. And I thought, why is that being reported as news? As a fan, like every book I've read on the Beatles, and I've read like dozens if not hundreds, that's in it. Why is that news? Yeah. That's not news to me.
Yeah, it's been said on camera in this situation.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a weird thing, isn't it? And have there been any interviews where you were particularly nervous beforehand? Because McCartney is one that springs to mind, knowing how much of a Beatles fan you are. How was that?
The first time, it was when I'd first started at Absolute, used to be Virgin Radio.
Yeah.
And I used to do a show with a guy called Pete, who I used to do local radio with in Manchester. And
the Pete and Jeff show.
That's right,
Legendary.
Yeah. And it's back when Chris Evans owned the radio station. Yeah. So I'd grown up in Manchester listening to Chris Evans on local radio, and then he'd hired us to come down here.
Yeah.
And so that was, you know, I was giddy because of that. And also it was like this weird time, like turn of millennium, and he was this guy on the front of the papers every day, and there was this huge drinking culture.
Yep.
And I was just sort of drunk all the time, you know.
Oh, well,
which, you know, at the time felt like fun. Now I'm a bit sort of embarrassed about it already.
It's a funny one, because there was certainly a period where drinking culture and just the social, even not acceptability of it, the social lauding of it was at an absolute peak. And it was the time when Chris Evans and Danny Baker and Gazza and these were the, look at these lads, aren't they?
Yeah,
great?
Whereas
it's weird now that you think that someone, it could genuinely be, you'd be worrying about the PR if you're seen staggering out somewhere drunk.
Yeah.
It's like at that point, that was the goal, pretty much.
He owned Virgin Radio and Ginger Media, who made TFI Friday and all this stuff, and we're all in this building in Golden Square. And like an email would go around at 11:30 in the morning from Chris's PA saying, oh, Chris has bought a new shirt and wants to celebrate everyone to the pub. And then you get to the pub and his credit card would be behind the bar, and that would be it for the rest of the day. And we used to come on the radio at like 7:00 at night, so I'd be slurring my words and so on. So anyway, the reason I mentioned that is like, so it'd been one of those days, and I was at home. I used to live in Bayswater in London, and I was kind of a bit hungover, and I didn't have a mobile phone at the time.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, had a landline rigged up to an answer phone. I never used to answer it because I'm just always scared it's going to be a bailiff or the bank or something terrible.
Yeah.
And a message came on the answer phone. Oh, we've had a call from work, from radio station. Yeah. We've had a call in. You can interview Paul McCartney this afternoon. You need to go to his offices in Soho Square. So I get so giddy. I think, oh my God, you know, after all this time of being this huge Beatles fan.
Kind of out of the
it was,
the
it
blue
was
as
completely
well, right?
out of the blue.
In a good way, because I guess there's no time to get.
Yeah, exactly. It's like just a few hours.
It's like, okay, just go.
And the closest I've been up to that point, I'd been to. So when I lived in Manchester, I'd done a little bit of work on a TV show up there. And then got to know friends who worked on TV. So we would just go to recordings of TV shows for the free booze. I think it was a recording of an awful quiz show called That Show Business with Mike Smith.
Right.
Who used to be Noel Edmonds' sidekick.
Yeah.
And Paul McCartney's brother, Mike McGeer, was one of the guests on it. And at that point, you know, just meeting Mike McGeer in the green room, oh my God, I'm one step away from a Beatle. And I've gone giddy because of that. So anyway, like 2-3 years later, and I'm in London, I get this call, I'm in my flat, and it's like, you've got to go interview Paul McCartney this afternoon. So I think, all right, I better go out. I need to go out, sit somewhere, have a sandwich, have a cup of coffee, think about what I'm going to do. And I went to the door of my flat and it was locked.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get out. And I realised that I'd come home drunk the night before. I'd put the keys in the door and somehow closed it behind me, but the keys were still in the door. Right. And there was no way out. Like, there was no, the windows all had bars on them.
This is awful.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, I'm going to miss out on interviewing a Beatle here. Yeah. So I had to ring work, and one of the kind of runners or whatever you call it, had to come round and pass me my keys. Unlock the door and then pass me my keys so that I could get out of the house. So we went.
Amazing.
So, because all this had gone on, like there'd been all this palaver.
Yeah.
I'd not really had any time to think about it before I interviewed him, which is probably the best way. And, you know, we went in and he'd done a rock and roll covers album at the time. It wasn't long after Linda had died. And I think it was like catharsis for him going back to this music that they'd loved. And he was just great, really funny and playful with us. And, you know, like I was saying before about not asking people what they've always been asked. If you sort of, if you, without seeming too wacky, if you can come out of a, out of the blue with them, they really enjoy it because, you know, they've spent a whole day answering these same old questions.
You'll be stunned at how much of a fine talent that is, though. Because again, it's very easy to go, I'm going to be a bit out of the blue.
But it'll then be you end up being sort of wacky.
Just,
yeah,
and it's just like,
yeah,
I've got no answer for that. Just.
This is why I think, like,
it's so weird because having done, like, when you have a load of interviews in a row, or if you're on tour and you're doing a lot of, particularly when you've got a record out and you're doing a lot of student press and stuff like that, or local press and things like that.
Yeah,
it is exactly that. It's a fine balance at points, and again, it's a balance that you've got and can now. But there have genuinely been points where I'm like, I just want him to ask me I was thinking when I, you know, I mean, I want the question I've answered a million times because I want to just get this over with.
Go into autopilot. Yeah, and I just want to go.
Bang, 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 bang. Thank you and good night.
Yeah,
on my way, because it will be the kind of, or it'll be an unusual question that's good, but I would have liked an hour to think about.
Sure.
What would you in this situation, or what is your favourite? This is.
Yeah,
man, I could think about this for hours.
Yeah.
But, damn it. Yeah.
That's why I often think like press interviewers are at an advantage because with a radio interview or a TV interview, you ask a question and you need a response straight away.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're doing one of the, like I used to read the NME or the Melody Maker or whatever, and you get the impression, okay, the journalists are just hanging out with this guy for half a day or 3 days and they're just writing about the best
bits. Getting the information. Yeah.
So you don't need to worry about the sort of awkward lulls or the bits which go wrong.
So how was it when you actually, I mean, you've now interviewed McCartney numerous times.
Yeah.
How is that now? And again, knowing, because you're a huge Beatles fan. Right?
Yeah.
Like, fanatically, hugely knowledgeable.
Yes.
Hugely into him. So how is that to then go, oh, that's Paul.
It's funny. So I always get, like, excited on the day, like, because it's usually quite short notice with him. And then when he comes in, I don't know what it is, but, like, just sort of, we've it's like taking the piss out of him a little bit, and he really seems to enjoy it, and then he sort of takes the piss back.
Right.
And I think it's weird to me because, like, what he probably doesn't know is nobody's more reverent of him.
Yeah.
And yet I go in there and I'm sort of cheeky
with
him. I don't know.
That's good. It's not what he's going to be used to, I guess. So and as you said, the key there is finding a way to make the person you're talking to comfortable and relaxed. So it's not this uncomfortable answer these questions and the pressure on the answers and all that. It's like, let's just have a chat.
I also think with him as well, and it's a weird thing because he's Paul McCartney, but I can feel like I want to present him in a certain light because I think there are people of maybe our age or younger or whatever that can sometimes put him in the same box as Cliff Richards. And I think, like, on one hand, it's great that he just doesn't care about being cool in a certain way.
Yeah.
You know, he's just this nice guy. He's funny in a way. He doesn't give a shit.
Yeah.
But then he's done all this amazing stuff, and the kind of avant-garde stuff that people assume was down to Lennon was often so much more driven by him.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I can feel like a responsibility, which, you know, he doesn't need my help. It's Paul McCartney. He doesn't need my help on some podunk radio station.
Yeah, it's that classic, a weird thing, though, isn't it, of the preservation of death, in that you've got Lennon is preserved there as the iconic cool one such, whereas Paul has grown up, has become a father, has become this, and you know, I mean, he it's similar, like everyone always says, Clapton and Hendrix as great examples. Right. Like, they were equally iconic and wild and unique and revolutionary. Yeah. Clapton, you now kind of think of as, oh, it's Clapton and Hendrix, yeah, preserved as this iconic,
although with Clapton,
mythical
it's,
creature.
It's kind of the Enoch Powell send them back racist rant that he did on stage right, in yeah. Birmingham in yeah. the 70s. I think that, that could,
yeah. There's that can poison the well up against, yeah. So, let's rewind all the way back. Growing up, was music a massive part of your life at school, in your teens?
Yeah, I mean, sort of yes and no. So I don't think I had any idea about sort of coolness of music or even being exposed to what we might think of as good music until I started and working in radio. But I always, like, when I was a kid, like, I'd take piano lessons and I'd always have, like, synthesizers. And, you know, I was always into that. But I think I just, you know, whatever was on the radio, Radio One, you know, whatever was on daytime Radio One was the music I heard.
It's a weird one because people who at any point are into music struggle to get their head around the fact that not everyone was born, you know, straight away had this huge relationship with hunting out the coolest songs or whatever else. If you've lived that, you can't imagine it any other way. But if you haven't, for a lot of people, music is a lovely thing in the background.
Yeah, I wish I had, because, you know, I feel so jealous of people who say, yeah, the first single I bought was The Clash or whatever it is. Because it wasn't like that for me. My dad had this one. We never really had albums. My dad had this one box of singles, and, you know, my dad's this sort of gruff northern guy, and bloody Beatles, I didn't care about them. I was into Elvis, you know, he's a bit like that. He says, well, you know, what thing about me is I can always spot a number one. So, which suggests that he's got some kind of good taste in music. Then you have this box of singles, and it was all over the place. It'd be like Elton John, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, or something good like that. Then, like, a horrible song about a man who gets married, and then him and his wife plant a tree, and then his wife gets sick, and then she ends up dying, and he's singing Honey, I Miss You, and Peter Sarstedt, Where'd You Go To, My Lovely? Because, you know, I like a song that tells a story, me. I mean, that's something my dad would say. So, I'd always be listening to records, and I'd be wanting to, like, slow them down and write the words down.
Yeah.
But I didn't have an older brother, and I don't feel like I had older cousins who had... I had lots of cousins, but I don't think there was that person who had good taste in music.
So I
like stuff I heard on the radio, and then when I was 14, you know, I'd hear things like Aztec Camera on the radio that I'd really like, and Human League, and bands like that. And then I started doing, a bit all over the place here, but I started doing mobile discos at about the time that Madchester became a thing.
Right, yeah.
So, like, I'd be 16 and doing these awful mobile discos in Macclesfield Rugby Club. And primarily they'd be people's, 40th birthday or wedding anniversary. Yeah. So it'd be all, like, the Birdie song and Agadoo and all that stuff. And then I used to do these Friday nights for the rugby team to fundraisers, and it became a big underage drinking spot. So people would come in with the hooded tops, and it'd all be about Happy Mondays and In Spiral Brilliant. Carpets and Stone Roses and the Smiths. So I think I first started hearing that stuff then, and then I worked in a record shop a bit when I was 16, 17, 18, and the guys there were into pretty good music. But really, I started working in
a record shop, can be particularly in of that age and that era, hugely influential.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
It was pre finding anything and everything on the internet.
Yeah.
It was when, you know, unless someone, as you said, you didn't have an older brother or any cousins, unless someone showed you this stuff, there was almost no way to find it. Like, you couldn't just stumble upon it.
No, and, you know, I never found John Peel, which I always feel sad about. Like, I think I would have been one of those kids. If I'd have found John Peel, it would have really clicked with me. So I started working in radio in South Manchester when I was 17. And what that radio station was, it was called KFM, but it quickly got sold to a local radio company called Signal Radio. But it was like whatever Six Music is now.
Right.
It was like a very small, low budget of that just for South Manchester.
So what kind of drew you there? Or was it from you were playing, you were DJing out, and then you kind of, you're drawn there? Because, again, it's just interesting that from speaking to you before, it would feel to me that until you started doing radio, you wouldn't expect that you would be comfortable doing radio.
Right, so it was sort of asked about, yeah, it was asked about tip for me, really, because, you know, I was this sort of geeky kid. Like, so I grew up in, like, a regular working-class family. My dad's a postman, my mum's a nurse. And from being a small kid, I was really into books or things that just... Like, even Star Wars, like, now, I feel like every fucker of my generation talks about how much a big thing Star Wars when they were a kid. I'm the exact age, 1973, so I was obsessed by it. But I was thought of as a bit of a weirdo because of how much I liked Star Wars. Because, like, just everyone was into football or whatever they're into. So it's, I'd be into...
It's the beauty of the retrospective appreciation of geekiness.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was a right geek.
No, because I lived through that and I suffered it and people weren't geeks.
I've seen numerous people... get angry on Instagram because there will be beautiful women and beautiful men who are like, I'm such a geek. You'll have a t-shirt on, but you'll be rippling with muscles. Or
you see it all the time.
Like, this is like, that's not what I remember being
Hollywood
a geek
stars
like.
And stuff. So, I'm such a geek.
You weren't in the Games Workshop with me, with me and Chris. That was me and my mates.
So the reason I mentioned that is I was like this really bookish kid, and it was such a novelty in my family. You know, like, so it wasn't in any way discouraged.
Yeah.
But the attitude being, oh, look at him with his book. Like, I was some kind of curiosity. So it's like this weird geeky kid, and when I was 11. Like, the teachers at my primary school had been saying, oh, look, you know, we think we could get him onto a scholarship for the local independent school, this school called King's School in Macclesfield.
Right.
So my parents, and it was a difficult thing for them, really, because my dad is sort of dyed-in-the-wool, old-fashioned labour, trade union guy.
Right,
My mum's a bit like that too. Yeah, but the teachers were saying, look, he's going to have a better chance if he goes to the school.
Yeah, you're off with your book learning.
Well, it was like that because they'd never see, you know, they'd never, it was an unusual thing. So they, you know, they put me through this entrance exam and I got this scholarship or whatever to this school. And I went there and it was fucking awful.
Right.
Like, I just didn't fit in at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd gone from not feeling like I fitted in anyway to thinking, okay, well, I want to go there because people maybe are into books and stuff, I won't fit in. But it was like, I don't know if maybe, like, I'm altering the memories a little bit, but it feels a little bit like everyone was so posh and like people's dads would come and pick them up in these posh cars and my dad would be in the post office van. And I'd have to lie in the back with the post in case his boss saw him because he shouldn't be ferrying his kid around. And I felt like I got really bullied and it was this unhappy time. So they took me out of that school and put me back into the local comp where I would have been anyway.
And then
I got bullied there.
I was going to say, because you're the kid from the posh school.
Exactly
no,
that thing.
I wasn't the common kid at the posh school. Now.
So all of this is to say, like, I was kind of like this weird bookish kid. And then aged 14 or something like that, all of a sudden I decided I was going to have this big personality.
Right.
Which, like, this is stuff that I'm still unpicking in therapy, Pip, you know. I don't know what's going on. But I decided I was going to have this big personality. So, you know, all of a sudden I'd be, like, wearing colourful clothes, I'd be larger than life. And I decided that I wanted to be a TV presenter because I used to watch, like, Jonathan Ross doing The Last Resort or whatever shows were on back then. So go to the careers teacher and say, what do you want to do? So I want to be a TV presenter and, you know, not interested in that. And they said, well, maybe I'd like to do something with music because I'm still playing piano. And then they give you a leaflet about, like, joining the army so you could be in the military band or whatever. So I'd buy all, like, Lookin, the magazines for teenagers, and I'd read the interviews with the TV presenters in the back. And it would say, so how did you get started in TV? Mm-hmm. And they would have all been on the radio.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, I need to go on the radio first. So, so then how do you go on the radio? And back then it was hospital radio because there's no internet radio or podcasts or anything. So I went and volunteered at my local hospital radio in Macclesfield. And just from going in a radio studio the first time, I just loved it. It felt magical to me. Like, I can smell it now. Like, I can still smell what the bays they used to soundproof the walls and the tables was like, and the and, you know, the smell of the old record library and stuff. And that was when I started getting into it. So then I thought, okay, I need to listen to loads of radio. And there was a station in Manchester called Piccadilly Radio.
Yeah.
So I listened to that. And then I wrote them a letter and asked if I could go in and answer the phones. And they let me. So I used to go there every night when I was 15, 16. I'd get the train after school to Manchester. It's like 18 minutes on the train into the city centre. And I'd go in and answer the phones and I just was obsessed with being around radio stations and radio. So it came from, and then to earn money from that, I thought, well, what do people who are on the radio do? Oh, they do disco. So that's right, why yeah. I started DJing. Yeah.
Did that experience in the radio change your demeanour and general personality at school? Because again, it feels, and not to over dramatise it, but it feels like you were in one school, you felt out of place, you went to another school and felt out of place, you went back and felt out of place, and finally you found somewhere that you felt at home and felt in place. And if that's at the same time and you were still at school, did that kind of give you more confidence in general? Because now it's like, I know who I am now. I'm Jeff that does the radio stuff.
A little bit, I work
for the radio and I do this. And that's kind of a cool thing now, maybe.
I don't think anybody thought that might be my thing. Yeah. That, I don't think anyone thought it was cool, but I just was like really obsessed with it. And I then went from being this kid who was always sort of at the top or near the top of the class with exams. I just wasn't interested anymore you know, I'd asked around and it seemed to me at that point, and I wouldn't advise it now, that like nobody was bothered whether you got GCSEs or not if you wanted to work in radio. So I just stopped working and I got terrible GCSEs and I was bunking off school all the time to go and sit in the radio studios and just play with the equipment.
I mean, that's going to be a fault there as well of the old style of careers advisor.
Yeah.
Because the fact is, if you've said, I want to do this, this and this, and they've gone, no.
Yeah.
It's like, right, well, you're advising me what I can do with the courses I'm doing at the moment and qualifications. So if you're telling me they can't help me get to radio, then...
I don't care then. And, you know, it really caused a lot of friction with my parents because they got this kid who they thought, oh,
you were meant to be the clever one.
Yeah. And all of a sudden, you know, they were going for parents' evenings and I found out I'd not been doing any work. I used to doctor my own school reports.
It's such a weird... a repeated story of conflicting situations in that, as said, you went to the posh school when you felt outcast, then you come back. In your family, you were the bright one. You know, if you hadn't been the bright one, then I'm sure the GCSEs results you got on that would have been absolutely expected. As you said, if you didn't come from a family that was particularly studied or bookish, then you know, but because you'd set that tone, then as soon as you go back to, oh no, I'm not, just, yeah. I'm not the bookworm type.
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
What do you mean? So, well, none of us are. Why?
Yeah,
the pressure's already
and it's,
there.
It's funny looking back, so like if I think I did it such a stupid way, really, but I didn't know any better because you know how it's so now I see kids coming on work experience and they're from, you know, wealthy families where they, you know, they live in London. Just the fact that they live in or near London and they can come into radio stations and do internships, you know, that helps. And there's these paths and people know people.
Yeah.
But, like, the difference from, like, at the time, like, it all makes sense now, but the difference at the time from going from my background to just being on the local radio in Manchester, it felt like this huge chasm. Like there was no way across it.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know anybody. Like, everybody I knew had, like, left school at 16 and then their dad knew somebody who needed somebody to do a bit of work. And, you know,
it's the thing that kills me the most about, I guess it's the idea of common sense or the assumed. And it's exactly that. It's like, well, I could never work on radio.
Yeah.
Because, as you said, it's this big chasm. It's something that's so far. But until you just went and did.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Until you look into it and find out. So, before we get back on that track, you mentioned obviously our radio has interns and that now.
Yeah.
How do people go about it now? If someone is listening to this thinking, man, this sounds like the kind of thing I'd want to do, is it just email radio stations, hit people up?
Yeah.
Hit people on Twitter, on email, or wherever you can?
I think it's simultaneously easier and harder now.
Yeah.
So if I wanted to do a radio show back then,
I had to
find somebody who would let me go and do it, if it was hospital radio, or somebody who'd let me go and do a film review on Piccadilly Radio or get onto the local radio. Whereas now, if you've got a phone or a laptop like everybody has, you've got GarageBand on it, you can do what you do.
Yeah.
And I actually think most of what I like in radio, what I do in radio, is going to be replaced by what you're doing.
Right, sure.
So I think the stuff the BBC does particularly is safe. I think we're so lucky to have the BBC in this country.
Yeah,
and to have a radio station, like, say, for example, Six Music, which doesn't follow any of the commercial conventions and people are allowed to be passionate about music and so on and so forth. We're so lucky to have that. But in terms of commercial radio, you almost have to divorce your interest in music from wanting to be on the radio, and it's depressing.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you want to, I hate the word curate, but if you want to create music, you can build a Spotify list, and you can put it on, you can share it on social media, or you can start your own club night, or whatever, or can maybe do an internet, like do a Mixcloud or an internet thing. So you can get that out that way.
It's and really if
you
feel like you've conflict, got, isn't it?
Yeah.
The fact that being passionate about music could work against you.
Oh, I think it absolutely does in commercial radio.
In commercial radio and the bigger areas.
Yeah,
I've told this story a few times, but I always remember I did a review show on Radio 1, and we had to review singles of the week, and there was me and a guy, I think, who worked at Rock Sound, and we both hated everything. And there was Greg James, and the beauty was he genuinely loved all of the poppier stuff, and it made me have a different appreciation of him on the radio.
Yeah,
because I was like, all right, this is absolutely fine. Because it kills me when you deep down know that this person is playing a song that they hate, and saying, here's the new single,
but
it's like, well, no, that's fine, because that's genuinely. And speaking to him even off air, he's like, yeah, I've been listening to that, it's my song, I love it.
Well,
I can't get
great.
Up. It's like, that's beautiful.
Great, I think
love
that's
that.
Quite rare because, yeah, so, you know, completely. I feel. And I don't know if it's a difference between BBC and commercial radio, but I feel that people are just told, you know, you've got to sell the music, you've got to be really enthusiastic about it. And I can't do it.
Yeah.
And then I hear people and they're being enthusiastic about everything. And I just think, oh, you don't like anything. You don't like any. We don't know you. We can't be trusted. Yeah. You're like like an oily salesman.
It's the bad reputations or impression that people would get of Eddie Temple Morris and Zane Lowe. Because they're so enthusiastic, but they were on shows where they could curate their own music. So you're not realising, but that's the reason they sound so enthusiastic. Because it's like, oh no, these are songs I really love.
Yeah,
this
and
is
I
the
love
best
it when you get
ever.
To. They used to let me do a Sunday night show where I play stuff like The Velvet Underground and The Smiths and Bell and Sebastian and stuff. And I loved doing that show. You know, it was just great being able to do a show where I'm enthusiastic about the music. But I think, like, you either going to be one of those guys or. Guys or girls, it's very DJ-ish, isn't it, who, you know, can go on and just be cheery and enthusiastic about the music. Or you do a sort of show where, you know, it's about talking to people or telling stories or getting stories from the listeners. And so I see my job, my day job, as that thing, really.
Completely.
And I have to kind of forget about 80% of the music that I'm playing.
And again, it's where it works so well, and it's... I think that's the key to getting an audience and maintaining an audience and a fan base in that respect. Because the fact is, all these songs are the same songs that are being played everywhere.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? There is a certain rotation that on certain...
Yeah.
So what will make your show stand out is the difference in between the songs. And again, they're sounds I like we're hating on songs. I think Absolute has got... some amazing songs on the playlist.
Oh, yeah, like every day I'm playing some David Bowie. Every day I'm, you know, I get to play
again,
Beatles,
so it's
Sex
not that.
Pistol.
It's not saying, oh, it's all this horrible stuff. But in general, what will make your show stand out is what's in between them. Because the fact is, those songs, and even more so, the way the internet and the world is now, you don't need to tune into your show anymore to listen to them songs.
No.
Whereas when we were younger, you would have to tune into the radio to hear these songs.
Yeah.
You can find them anywhere you want now. You can go and listen to them of your own accord. You can listen to them 20 times in a row and never pay once for them, kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know?
So and this is kind of a point about people who want to get started in radio. So if, like, what you really want to do is share music, you've got all these ways of sharing music now which don't involve being on the radio. And if you want to do... if what you want to do is
Spotify
talk...
playlists and all that kind of thing.
And if what you want to do is sort of tell stories and... you know, talk to people, like do what you do a podcast. Like it's so liberating in a way that you don't need to go begging to a radio station anymore. The trouble is you know, like anything, how do you...
It's finding the platform finding that initial...
Yeah, how do you cut through? How do you cut through? And I suppose ultimately, you know, you want to make a living out of it. How do you do that?
Yeah.
But that's what I would do. You know, even now I think to myself... do I want to be on the radio that much longer? Or like, I listen to what you do. I think it's so good, and the way you've built this little empire, and the way you've got all the little spin-off things going, and the shows, and so on. I think, like, if I thought I could get the audience,
yeah,
quickly, I'd do that instead of being on the radio, maybe.
Or my thought, though, is there is a one answer to this question that we've tried to do. I would say if you want to do a podcast or a blog, it's not going to hurt as well if you can get some time interning at a radio station or this or that. Because again, you could then find that, oh, I can actually, there's actually room for me, as you said, to come on every Friday and review a film. And then I can kind of write, well, then I've started to get this audience and fan base, and it can be a little nod to, oh, I've got a full film podcast over here every week. But I think there's loads of ways. And getting around people as well, I think that's key. It's the podcasting world is great, but also it could end up just restricting yourself because you don't need anyone else. You might never meet anyone. Do you know what I mean? You might never ever meet anyone else that can then help you or take you on.
And there's a value in learning the nuts and bolts of it as well. So, you know, you don't want to sound like an old-style radio announcer, but there are things you can learn about, you know, as simple as what you were saying before about mic technique, but, you know, how to speak to people, the shape and arc of a show or a story or whatever. There's value in that. And people who've, you know, there's some great people on radio. And as I keep saying, you know, we're lucky in this country to have BBC Radio. There's so much to learn from listening to that.
Completely. So let's go back onto your a journey here from starting out and getting internships and getting some time on small radio stations in Manchester to suddenly finding yourself in the Big Smoke. And was that always... Because, again, it's changed in recent years, but there was a point where for radio and TV, you're aiming at London.
Well, I wasn't at all, you know, like I say, then when I found out to get on telly, you had to go on the radio, and then I got into the radio. All I wanted to be was on Piccadilly Radio in Manchester.
Brilliant.
I just loved it. It felt, you know, it used to come from this building right in the middle of the city in Piccadilly Gardens, and there was a huge tower with all these transmitters and aerials and satellite dishes on top. And it felt like it's like beaming out over the whole city. And I used to listen to a guy called James H. Reeve, who was the late night guy.
Right.
I suppose a bit like what somebody like Ian Lee is doing now. It was a talk show, a phone-in show, but he wasn't like so often you'll hear on LBC or talks, but it wasn't one of these kind of string them up, send them back, anti-immigrant guy. It was a guy called James H. Reeve, and he was very liberal in his way. He was very slow and sardonic, and he would tell these long stories from life, which, you know, if you heard a stand-up, if you heard a stand-up saying them on stage, you'd say it was a masterclass in observational comedy.
But
it wasn't. It was just a guy telling stories on the radio. And like people would be writing in and people would be phoning in. And when I listened to that show, it felt like you're a member of a club. Mm. So like I was out in my bedroom in Macclesfield, and like I say, I always felt like a bit of a square peg or whatever.
Yeah.
But then you got the idea all over the region and all around the city, there are these people listening and thinking the same things, and there's all these in-jokes. And so I just thought I'd really love to do a show
that's
like that, really. So I went from there to this radio station, which is like a very local version of Six Music, KFM in Stockport. And amazing people were on it. Like John Ronson started off there, and he was just kind of leaving as I was getting there, kind of answering the phone. So I remember John being this sort of cool guy who'd drift in and out with his roll-up cigarettes, and Terry Christian used to do a show on there.
Yeah.
But the one for me was Craig Cash, who, you know, went on to co-create and star in The Royal Family and Early Doors.
Of course.
So I ended up on there, and Craig really took me under his wing.
Fantastic.
And Craig used to do the show at night, and he used to come on at 10 o'clock. And firstly, I mean, he's just so funny. He's such a great storyteller. He's got such a great way of looking at things. Secondly, he didn't sound like David Lee Travis or Simon Bates or one of those guys on the radio. So that was great. That's somebody who just sounded like an ordinary person was on the radio. And thirdly, the music. And this is when I got into music. Like, he'd play the Pixies followed by Frank Sinatra and you know, like a Pavement song, then Johnny Cash. And all this stuff now, if you listen to Six Music, you think, oh, yeah, well, we've got a radio station that sounds like that. But nobody was doing it. Sounded like nothing. And so Craig ended up being a mentor to me.
That's fantastic.
But also being like my John Peel. So I would finish and I'd go home and listen
to... started or done stuff in radio, because obviously all the TV stuff, and then he recently... Yeah. Rovers, I thought, was fantastic. He was behind or involved in After Hours, which I thought was another really...
That's right, with John and Molly,
yeah.
Yeah, and he's one of these people. who would hate it if I said it, anything in any way gushing
about
him. Bloody hell, Lloyd, you've embarrassed yourself again. but, you know, he's just such a brilliant, decent, funny, clever man. And in some ways, I feel like everything I've done since, I've just been trying to do what Craig told me to do, you know?
It's awesome to have something like that early on as kind of
man, and then I got fired. So Craig got fired off the radio, I think, in mid 94 in the radio station in Stockport, and then I got fired at the end of 94.
Oh, what did you get fired for? What was the?
I had trying to
avoid it.
Well, no, I'll tell you. Like, I had a mental breakdown.
Right.
So I'm now 43, and kind of like I've had stuff going on with mental health, you know, including my alcoholism for a long time, but it sort of started when I was 21, the big episode when I was 21, and I went a bit nuts and vanished and hitchhiked to Paris and like got sort of strange delusions and so on, and got back, you know, I was supposed to be, I'd been out, it's a difficult story to tell, not because it's difficult emotionally, but just it doesn't have a good arc particularly, but you know, I'd started to hit the drink like people do, sort of 19, 20, 21, but then, you know, as I now know, I'm quite predisposed to darkness or depression or whatever, and it's just a terrible mix for people like me. So it's sort of spiraling a little bit with the drinking, and
particularly at a time and a situation with Manchester or whatever else, when it'd be very encouraged and very...
Well, this is 94, enabled. And it's like when kind of like Oasis are coming along, and it feels like post-Manchester, the city's rising again. And even though I wouldn't put an Oasis record on these days, at the time it felt very exciting.
Hugely.
So I'd be going out to all these gigs, and things weren't going great at the radio station in terms of how they treated me. And, you know, I used to get paid £20 for a weekend show and £25 for a weekday show.
Yeah.
And like all the other guys were on £50 or £60 a show. And I remember Craig going mad at this because like I was getting paid so little compared to everyone else. Yeah. And like him going in and like yelling at the boss in the open plan office in front of everyone going, yeah, but you know, Jeff's younger. And Craig's going, yeah, but fucking Ryan Giggs is younger than the rest of the team, but they're not paying him differently. You know, so he was always like really sticking up for me like that. Yeah. But so anyway, it's kind of like getting into debt and my drinking was going out of control. And, you know, I don't know why it was this night rather than any other, but I'd been to see Primal Scream. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then went out drinking afterwards. And then I got this craziness, really, or this delusion in my head that I didn't want to live in Manchester anymore. I was going to go and live in Paris, and I was going to be a musician.
Right.
You know, so...
It's a big jump to...
Yeah. So that's what I'll do then. So I, you know, drunk, went to Chorlton Street bus station in Manchester.
Oh, wow.
And... took a bus down south, I don't even know, like, and somehow, like, still drunk, ended up in Dover.
Wow.
And then, like, damn, sort of took the ferry as a foot passenger and then sort of hitchhiked to Paris. And because I was so drunk, it's difficult to remember the detail of it, but I remember, like, being in the cab of this huge lorry with a French lorry driver, and he's got all these bottles of Stella in a crate.
Oh, wow.
In his cab, and I'm drinking this, like, he's driving this huge truck and I'm crazy and drinking this with him, and then he drops me off somewhere, and then I get picked up by a guy who, you know, with hindsight looks like he could have been a murderer. He was listening, he drove very slowly on the motorway, didn't go above say 30, and he was just listening to Disney songs all the time.
Oh, wow, that's dark.
And there was something really creepy about it.
Yeah.
And I ended up in Paris and I went and slept under a bridge, and then, you know, at some point over the next day or so, I came to my senses and thought, oh, hang on a minute, so I can't really play a musical instrument, I can't speak French, I don't have any money, I've got nowhere to be,
this
perhaps wasn't made in a rational frame of mind, so kind of then, you know, ended up like having a bit of a break and calling my parents, and they had to somehow buy me a train ticket to Calais, and then I came back on the train, and I just sort of had a kind of full-on breakdown, really. Yeah. And you know, they sent me to the doctor, and that was the first time I went on antidepressants. And the doctor sent me to the mental hospital, not as an inpatient on this occasion, yeah. But it was so in Manchester, the two kind of mental hospitals, there's Macclesfield Parkside and there's one in Prestwich, you know, yeah. these two old, very Gothic Victorian mental hospitals where you imagine people locked up in a tower, yeah. Flew over the cuckoo's nest-ish. And I went there and I got diagnosed at that point as bipolar.
Yeah.
Which you know, then they say, do you want to go on lithium? Which was the only thing they had at the time, and I didn't want to go on lithium because
again,
I was,
it'll be early days of any understanding of
yeah, I think
of bipolar
so.
And early days of any diagnosis. And
yeah.
Like
so anyway, the reason I mention all this, so I had a bit of a breakdown, and so when I got back, I don't know if I called the radio station or my mum called the radio station or whoever it was and said, look, he's not been very well. He's, and the radio station, oh, don't worry. You know, it's fine. These things happen. We're here for him. Tell him to take as long as he wants to get right. And then he can come back anytime he likes. So, you know, a month passed or whatever it was, or 3 weeks. And, you know, I called and said, I'm ready to come back. And they said, that's not going to happen. We put somebody else on.
Oh, damn.
Yeah, because, you know, people didn't back then.
Yeah.
It was just scary to people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, the friend I had who I'd been out to see Primal Scream with, you know, everyone was worried about me because I should have turned up for a radio show and I didn't turn up, and the work experience kids ended up doing it, and it was a mess. But, you know, back then, like some of my friends, like, you know, Craig was so great with me. He'd come round or he'd ring and... I find it difficult to talk about it in a way because, you know, I don't want to...
Sure.
I don't want to show emotion particularly about it, but then other people, because it was so weird and mental health wasn't talked about back then, some people just couldn't handle it. So this one friend who I think I've been seeing, you know, wouldn't return my phone calls anymore. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm 21... and I'm living back in my bedroom at my parents' house, and I've been fired off the radio, and I've had this breakdown.
I mean, I was going to say, that's a huge amount to deal with regardless of everything else that's just happened or mental state, to go, all right, I'm back at square one.
Yeah, so I'm just in this depression. And then Craig and Caroline Ahern, they're always so great to me, and they made a job for me on the Mrs. Merton show.
Oh, amazing.
So they didn't, you know, the show was in production already and they didn't need anybody else, but they kind of badgered the producer into giving me this job. And the job really was, during the show, making sure that Caroline was just drunk enough but not too drunk. So they used to record at the BBC in Manchester on Oxford Road. And
the drunk monitor.
Yeah, it was. And Caroline at the time... like, her drink was Asti Spumante. You know, like the sort of the cheap, nasty... She loved Asti Spumante. So my job really was going and making sure that Caroline had got Benson and Hedges and Asti Spumante.
Brilliant.
But it was great. And, you know, they just looked out for me.
You see, what's great and interesting there, it was recently Mental Health Awareness Day.
Yes.
And there was a lot of posts online and... obviously, we talk a lot about mental health on the podcast. There's a whole chapter of it in the book. And it was an interesting one. I read a lot of amazing posts, but I chose not to do any simply because I think we're at a point now where a day like that is hugely important and raising awareness, but it should also be an everyday thing. And particularly back then, it wouldn't have been at all. But I think we're getting more and more to the point where we should be able to discuss and have open conversations about these things any day, every day, regularly. And that's not to downplay the importance of Mental Health Awareness Day, because it's hugely important and it is about reaching out, giving people a set time to be able to feel comfortable to share their story, giving people who still are in that place where they just are scared to hear about that, you know, kind of forcing it in their face. But equally, as said, it's that thing. I thought about it and thought, no, I'd rather continue to discuss it regularly than feel... I've done my bit.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I do. And it's a funny one because it feels so... if you're a certain type of person, I think it feels really normalised.
Yeah.
And yet, as I say that, I think I've got some of my closest friends, people who were at my wedding, who I've probably never said the word bipolar to with relation to myself.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I don't... I've had various assessments over the years, some of which agree with that, some of which don't. But the point being that even though I consider myself a sort of modern, liberal, open person, it's not that you can't talk about these things. It's that you think, oh God, people are going to think it's boring, or like people completely. Are going to think, I'm not sure if I want to go for a cup of tea with Jeff because he's going to whine on about his anxiety.
The way I was thinking about it was similar to, I remember when there was the BBC did a poetry week thing, and every night of the week on BBC Two there was staff on poetry, and they talked to me about a load of different ideas, and we never ended up doing any. But then about a month later, I had another idea and I hit one of them up. And they were like, oh, no, we've done Poetry Week.
Right, yes.
Oh, right. So so Poetry Week is saying, here's the only time we're going to address. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
It was that kind of thing. It was a weird one. But the other thing I wanted to touch upon that story, which I think is really important for people to hear, I talk a lot about how important it is to be open to getting help, to go in doctors and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But it is such a unique and specific thing to each individual person. And the key part in that story for me was you went and got help, you spoke to doctors, granted it's when they were a little bit less understanding things, but what it seemed to actually take was some friends helping out.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It wasn't necessarily the doctor's diagnosis or the medication or anything else. It was Craig and Caroline going, look, come and do this. Do you know what I mean? So some friends actually reaching out and going to something that it wasn't the biggest or hardest thing for them to do.
No.
It was very much within their capabilities, but was life-changing at the time to you, I'd imagine, or meant the world to you at the time.
And I think, like, weirdly,
it's weird how small a thing can be to someone. And,
in
be a massive
in a way, it comes out of not... No, you know, if you don't know how to talk about something like that, you think, what can I do?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think, like, talking is the thing.
Yeah.
But actually, if you pitch it just right, some practical things thinking, okay, what can I do in this person's day that is going to give them structure or distraction as well as support?
And it's a combination because it's distraction or whatever else, but it's also, well, you know, not that we can keep an eye on them, but we can be around if they do want to talk. Even if you're not comfortable approaching them to say, do you want to talk?
Yeah.
Kind of go, let's be around and discuss in general. So if they want to bring anything up, then there's opportunities. Do you know what I mean?
There's
a lot of things like that. That's a
key part there. You know, like with the World Mental Health Day thing, I think the thing that they were going for this year was trying to normalise talking about it.
Which, again, I said, I don't want any mistake at all that I was speaking against World Mental Health Day. I think it was, and again, I saw so many amazing stories shared and really inspirational stuff. So,
and
yeah,
it's funny, Lou, you even give a little bit of that, and the catharsis that comes after it for people. So a few years ago, when Robin Williams died, I was sort of reading the news stories, and I was becoming really perturbed, I suppose, by this idea of, oh, yeah, well, you know, he's this creative genius, and with genius comes madness.
Yeah.
Because I think for most people who have mental health issues or who suffer with depression or whatever, it's not stars, it's not comedians, it's not writers.
Yeah.
It's just everybody. And there's something about it that perhaps glamorizes it in some way.
Yeah.
Or makes it other. And on the day he died, I thought, I want to talk about this a little bit on the radio. And sort of, like, when I talk on the radio, I feel like I'm quite honest generally, but, you know, I'm honest about my bowel movements, about how uncomfortable an interaction was with a waiter in a cafe or whatever.
Yeah.
I kind of don't get into it because I don't want to seem self-serious.
Yeah.
And so I thought, okay, how can I talk about this without being self-serious? And anyway, the short answer is I didn't. I ended up kind of talking about this thing, and I didn't talk about like stuff with my own mental health because I haven't really. This is the first time I talked about it, but I think it was perhaps apparent to people where it was coming from.
Yeah.
And I don't really, really even remember what I said particularly, but the gist was, let's not just think this stuff belongs to like incredibly creative geniuses. It's everybody. It's your friend. It's people in the pub. So I just started talking about this, and I don't know how long it went for, maybe like 15 minutes, which is longer than I would usually just talk as a monologue for. And I finished it, turned the microphones off, and I just had this horrible feeling like I'd really embarrassed myself.
Right.
Like, because I'm constantly like worried about embarrassing myself or humiliating myself. And I couldn't make eye contact with my producer or Annabelle, my co-host, or anybody like this. I just thought, oh God, why did I do that? And so I just turned the speakers up in the studio and I look at my piece of paper and then anyway, like then these text messages start coming in and tweets. And this goes on for days and I've never, you know, never had anything like it.
Yeah.
And it's all these people who were listening who have either, you know, it just meant something, somebody talking that openly on the radio. And again, it's one of these things that I don't like talking about now because I feel a bit sort of self-serious. But I was in floods of tears for days because people were saying, you know, I was on my way to drive my car off a bridge and I heard this and, you know, just this stuff. And, you know, I can feel in my job like I'm a real failure a lot of time. I can feel like I haven't accomplished what my friends have accomplished or what I would have liked to have accomplished. And then you have a day like this and I know it sounds horrible and pretentious, but you think, oh God, people listen. And every now and again, it means something to people.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And it's interesting what you were saying about how I said, it's not just creative genius or this, that. When I had Limmy on the podcast, one of the best bits he said was he was like, one of the things that, like, he feels really lucky that he got an opening in comedy.
Right.
Because he realised that prior to that, some of his friends did just think of him as the mental guy. Right. And not in a crazy mental, but genuinely, he'll say some weird shit.
Yeah,
He's not all there.
Yeah.
It's like, he then happened to get to turn that into sketches and do his rants and they're,
and he's
they're
so
genius.
Like, I think he's so good at talking about that stuff
in
a way that feels completely natural. I'm full of admiration for the way that he would talk about that stuff. And it doesn't, you know, I don't know. Like, I can feel sometimes if I'm talking about it, I seem like, if I've got this image of myself as like this kind of bookish, specky guy who's, you know, can get a bit carried away with himself or seem a bit pretentious or something. But I hear somebody like Limmy talk about it and I feel like it's so well expressed.
But it's because you're hearing it from someone who isn't you.
Yeah.
And that's what you can't get when listening to yourself. As stupid as that sounds, but the way everyone else is hearing you is the way you're hearing Limmy.
I don't know. A friend of mine said a great thing to me the other day. I went for lunch with a friend and I was moaning about how everything's going or whatever I'm doing. And he gave this great analogy about the theatre, which is, there's two ways into a theatre. You can either go in as a customer, as a patron, and you go in through the front and it's all geared to your experience and the experience is lovely. There's, you know, refreshments there and lots of kind of lush carpet and ornate decoration. Then you go to your seat and it's comfortable and you're looking at the stage and it's very beautiful. And then it starts and it's so well lit and you're the person watching it and that's how it seems to you. Or you can go in the back way and you go in the back way and it's like some grotty old fire escape and there's graffiti on the wall and people are screaming at each other and you're worried about going out on the stage and something's gone wrong and you've got to cover it up and then you go out there and you do it. And that's an amazing experience in itself, being out on a stage and experiencing that and experiencing the appreciation. But whatever you feel as the one going in through the back door, that's not how the people out front are seeing it.
And he
was telling me this really about my about how I'm constantly worrying about what people think of me or how am I coming across because I'm
in the back,
seeing
everything else, and everyone else is getting to watch that.
But he also, you know, he also said, he was talking about it as
it's a great analogy
in terms of creative endeavors as well, in as much as you know, if you're a creator of something, you know, be it stories on the radio or music like you do or a film or whatever, once you've gone in the back way, you can never see it the other way again. You'll always see the strings. And for whatever the rewards of that are, you never get to experience it purely as a fan of that thing ever again.
Completely. It's a bizarre one, purely on the little bits of acting I've been doing now, of seeing things being shot.
Yes.
I think I've been quite good at switching it off again, but certainly the first time I was on set for like a month, I love going to the cinema. Any film I'd go and see, I'd be thinking about everyone that's on the other side of the camera,
yeah,
and all the people that are here, and how this shot that followed that directly and is in the same location was shot at a different time because you couldn't have had a camera there because we were just there. There wasn't a camera there. This conversation isn't a real... All that, it's just, this is horrible. it's really... But similarly, again, you can take some of it back. It always... A lot of my mates are always surprised that if I'm ever going to see anyone I know do a gig or do stand-up or whatever else, I need to be in the crowd. I don't want to be side stage. I don't want to be watching from side stage because that feels like you're number one, it's purely a logical thing because all the speakers are set up for the crowd.
Yeah.
They're not set up for the position. That's like a gig... If you've got a good sound man, they put a lot of effort into making sure that each speaker is just right, each level. If you're watching it from the side of the stage, you're not going to get in that correctly.
Once, go and see what it looks like.
Yeah, but
it's not... I don't understand when you see, I don't know, XX tabloid celebrity going to a festival, and they're always at festivals, but yet they're always watching from the wings.
Yeah.
Why would you do that? Okay, yeah. I understand it must be awful for some of these people because they're
hugely famous and wherever else, but still.
But at the same time, it's no way to see a show, is it?
No, I agree. Well, I'll start to wrap things up as we're almost at the 90-minute mark.
It's
a nice long one. I wanted to kind of just quickly... there's loads of stuff I haven't got round to, but that's the sign of a good guest, so it's a good work. Despite the fact at one point Elika was audibly snoring at our conversation.
Yeah, I wonder.
So other than that, I wanted to put my mic to it.
If you turn your headphones up really loud, I think early the baby was crying downstairs as well.
One thing you touched upon there with, or when you mentioned a Robin Williams passing, and one thing I find fascinating is you're involved in something that is essentially a never-ending story. Mm. It's not his series one, there's 10 episodes and then it's over. You're in and speaking to people every day.
Yes.
And it continues on. We're at a time, well, not particularly, I mean, every time is a time when there's a lot of stuff going on in the world. How do you kind of choose what you address and what you don't address? It's weird. I liken it to, I get hit up a lot online about if I'll do this tweet for this a charity thing, and I'll always try to explain in as clear and polite a way as possible. It's not good for me to do that because if I'm doing a charity post every day, none of them will get any attention.
Yeah.
The way we are with social media is you'll breeze over it. If I do one and I've not done any the rest of the year because it's something that means something to me, it will have an effect and it will get attention. The fact is, if you're doing a run to raise money for an illness that killed a close friend of yours, posting it to your 1,000 friends will mean so much more than me posting it to my 100,000 people who are into my music but don't necessarily...
Yeah.
care about this post. So how do you choose kind of what you address and what you don't address and what comes up? Have you ever felt I should address that but I'm not comfortable, or we should talk about this or we shouldn't?
A little bit. I mean,
because it's a weird one, it's not a news show, but it is a show that does discuss stuff that's going on.
So the Robin Williams thing is kind of an anomaly because there was a seriousness to that.
Yeah.
And I think people responded to it because the seriousness is so rare from me that it stood out. So
it's an example of exactly what I was saying.
Exactly.
The charity thing. It means that if you choose one, if you were, particularly this year, if you were doing a big heartfelt speak of every famous person that died, you'd struggle to do anything else.
Absolutely.
Whatever the year we're having. But yeah, I guess
Yesterday, we're recording this the day after Lily Allen was taking all this flack for speaking out on behalf of the refugees in Calais. And
for travelling there to go and see. And be, it's not some tweet that she's just casually thrown out.
And you know, it's really depressing, the response of people, and it can make you quite misanthropic and so on. So I was thinking yesterday, should I say something about this on the radio? And I think, well, I've got nothing to add to it. So I see, and I tend to see more radio than I hear in a certain way, James O'Brien, those little video clips. Yeah. And he's so articulate and so great about getting into those things.
Yeah.
When in actual fact, that's not what I do. And if I tried to do that every day, it wouldn't be very good. So in answer to your question, it's usually I'll look through the news or look through my life or look, you know, walk about scribbling things that occurred to me or things that happened to me and think, okay, have I got anything kind of funny to say about this? Or have I got an angle on this? And it's what makes the cut is like, have I got anything on it?
Really? Do you enjoy that?
Yeah.
Like having that as part of your life? Because I remember, again, the times I've been on the newspaper review, it's been hugely enjoyable to take that moment to look for funny stuff a bit more. Whereas, again, particularly when there's times of heaviness going on in the UK or America or wherever else, you might not notice all that. You'll be so, all you're seeing on social media is misery and anger and sadness. But your job is to each day really find at least a few things that are quite funny and quite light and quite pleasing about the world.
Yeah, that's, and it's one of those things, right? Like, sort of in a way, the more you embarrass yourself, the better it is as well. I'm trying to think of an example. Like, this is a horrible one. But, like, so a few years ago, I was living in this house where the bedroom was on the top floor.
Yeah.
And the bathroom was two floors down.
Right.
And I got into the habit, and this is disgusting, of sleeping with a jar next to the bed.
Amazing.
So that I just urinate into a bedpan during the night. And like the day I started doing that, I thought, I must never speak of this to anybody. And then like within a couple of weeks, like, it comes out of it, falls out of my mouth on the radio.
Yeah.
And then like people are texting in, oh, my husband does that, or I do that. Amazing. Or like I keep a Starbucks cup in my van that I pee. You know, I know this is kind of base, but the point being that, like, I think I heard the writers of Peep Show, Sam Bain and Jesse Armstrong, say if you've got something that you think you can never say to another human being because it would make you seem too weird, that's the thing that people are going to really connect with.
100%.
Because nobody's, 100%. You know, we're all as weird as, we're all walking around pretending we're not as weird as we are.
Yeah.
We think, okay, everyone else is normal, so I'm going to have to act normal.
Yeah.
But everyone's, you know, everyone's insane underneath, right?
Indeed they are. That's a perfect note to end it on. Thank you very much. So where can people keep up to date on everything you do and your goings on?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter. You know, you can find me on there. I'm on Absolute Radio. I've been there for 18 years.
That's amazing.
Do you think?
Yeah.
I keep thinking like...
Because you've been there longer than it's been Absolute Radio, right?
I was there, 10 years of Virgin Radio,
so
8 years.
That's all the more impressive. You've been on a radio station that's been going 8 years. You've been on it for 18 years.
I keep saying to Annabelle, who I do the show with, like, we should try and learn when to leave the party. Like, you don't want to be the person who's at the party too long. And Annabelle said to me, I said this to her the other day, and she said, I think maybe we should have left the party 2 or 3 years ago.
No, but again, it still works and it's great. And as you've seen, it's one of the shows that I'm always up for coming on and excited to be, because it is fun and it does feel like you're all enjoying it.
Yeah.
And everyone's having a good time. It doesn't feel like it's another episode to feel, what we're going to do today.
I look at you and here you are. You're living the life. You're going around with your tape recorder. I think maybe this is the way to do it.
I mean, if you're ever thinking of going that route, I know a guy. I can give you some tips. I can give you some advice.
Is this the bit where you play your xylophone now?
Yeah, exactly. It is. Well, thank you very much, Jeff. Cheers.
You've been listening to Scrooby's Picks.
There we go. How lovely is Jeff? And man, that got beautifully heavy. He's so his openness and honesty was absolutely wonderful. And it's weird because we've had a few different episodes where we get onto some heavy topics and there's some huge openness. It's easy to start taking that for granted, and we shouldn't. Like, we shouldn't take that for granted at all. It means the world that he felt comfortable enough to talk about a lot of this stuff for the first time, you know. Yeah, it meant the world he felt comfortable and brave enough to discuss this. And it means it's a great step towards more people feeling comfortable to discuss if they're struggling or if they're having a rough time or if things aren't quite right. So, yeah, huge love to Jeff Lloyd. Make sure you let him know that you enjoyed this episode, because it was amazing.
Yeah, and I think he's great, and I highly recommend his show. I think he's one of the most naturally engaging and warm and interesting people on radio at the moment. So check that out. Speaking of naturally engaging and warm and interesting people on the radio, next week's guest is Ian Lee. You don't want to miss that one, believe me. Thank you very much for tuning in. I will see you next week. This has been the Distraction Pieces podcast. My name is Scroobius Pip. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.